Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Christopher Leonard, says, if you want to understand how unions were killed, how the income divide widened, how climate change progress stalled, and how corporate America came to have so much influence in the United States, you have to understand the story of Koch Industries. It is the second largest privately held company in the U.S., earning $115 billion in annual revenue. Charles and the late David Koch are worth a whopping $120 billion. So how have they made their money, and how did they become so powerful? Those are the questions Christopher Leonard aims to answer in his new book, Kochland, The Secret History of Koch Industries and Corporate Power in America. Koch derives the majority of its profits from oil refineries, and according to the Political Economy Research Institute, Koch Industries is the 14th worst air polluter in the United States, above oil giants like BP, Shell, and Chevron. And in the new book, Kochland, Christopher Leonard writes, Koch oil seemed to be built for the very purpose of avoiding outside scrutiny. The company was owned by Koch Industries, a conglomerate based in Wichita, Kansas. The company was family-owned and private. It seemed that nobody in either the Senate or the FBI had ever heard of the firm when they began investigating it in 1988. They mistook it for Coca-Cola, the soft drink maker in Atlanta. Senate investigators learned that Koch Oil was the single largest purchaser of crude oil in the United States, and over the decades, it has quietly bought up tens of thousands of miles of pipelines and trucking services. But that's not all. Christopher Leonard goes on to write that millions of Americans use Koch products when they fill up their car's gas tank, but no one seemed to even know the company's name. Christopher Leonard is a business reporter and award-winning author. His work has been published in many publications, including The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal. And his latest book is called Kochland, The Secret History of Koch Industries and Corporate Power in America. And Chris joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. You worked on this book for almost 7 years, and It is very deeply reported. It is almost 600 pages long. You interviewed dozens of current and former Koch employees, whistleblowers, bankers, and more. And I've watched you give talks, and you said that one of the reasons why you decided to tackle this project is because, as a business reporter, you became really concerned about economic inequality and the influence of corporations in this country.
That's exactly right. And this would have been back in about 2011. And there were these big questions about what was going on in our economy that really concerned me back at that time. Income inequality being a big one, and that's a really overused term. Let me explain what I mean by that. We're closing in right now on the end of a decade of uninterrupted economic growth. That's a pretty astounding, in many ways, positive thing. But it is uncontroversial when you look at it that over the last 10 years, the majority of Americans have effectively not advanced at all economically. There was a front page story in the Wall Street Journal, middle class swamped in debt. Wages are stagnant. Costs are rising. People are plugging that hole by borrowing money. The economy is growing. Massive profits are being realized. It's just being captured by a very small group of people. So why is that? Why is this the case? How did we get to this point? And I kind of had this realization that the story of this one institution and this one company, Koch Industries, was a perfect vehicle to explore that question.
How did you go about doing this? Because, as you note in the book, a number of articles have been written. There's Jane Mayer's book about the Koch brothers. In fact, Charles Koch, and we'll talk about this later, went on a sort of public relations tour where he gave interviews to people like Joe Scarborough on MSNBC and Steve Inskeep on NPR to try to change the image of Koch Industries and the Koch brothers. So what were the main questions you were setting out to answer?
Yeah, I wanted to write, and first of all, Jane Mayer's book on the Koch network and other right-wing billionaires, Dark Money, is a fantastic book, really groundbreaking. And, I mean, she broke a lot of ground on this story and was sort of the first out front and took a lot of heat for it, you know, which we can talk about. But to me, there were a lot of unanswered questions about the corporate empire itself. I'm a business reporter. I want to write about economics. I want to write about corporate America. I want to write about corporate structures. And I want to write about corporate influence over our public policy and our public lives. There, when I started working on this in 2012, the iceberg hadn't been revealed. And what I mean to say by that is the massive corporate empire that produces these billions of dollars that are used every year to influence our politics, this massive machine that is embedded in almost every aspect of our daily life, that's what Koch Industries is. So I spent years reporting on oil refining, nitrogen fertilizer production, derivatives trading, the petrochemical business that makes our clothing items, all of these things. I say that Koch really specializes in the kinds of businesses that underpin modern civilization: building materials, clothing, fuel, light, electricity, commodities trading. It's this stuff that's like just below the surface of what we do every day, and you couldn't even boycott it if you wanted it to. And so I wanted to illuminate the corporate empire and kind of explore what it says about our economic and political system.
And what's so interesting is Koch Industries is not publicly traded, so there's no stock. As you point out, the business press and the cable shows don't really talk about Koch Industries like they do other companies, especially when the earnings come out, whether their stock is up or down. And you start off with an interesting story about what happened when four Wall Street bankers traveled to Wichita, Kansas on May 18th, 1981. And they were there to make an offer to Charles Koch to take the company public.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically said, why would we do that?
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to be under a microscope. And look how much money we're making.
That's right. It was such a telling episode. That's why I opened the book with it. These four bankers from Morgan Stanley fly to Wichita. This is in the early 80s, and they're telling Charles Koch, take your company public. First of all, you, Charles Koch, will get, I think it was a $23 million bonus that day for going public, which translates to about $60 million today. And it was conventional wisdom at the time that you take a company public because you get access to a lot more money. Charles Koch sent these bankers back home empty-handed. And I got the memo they wrote when they got back, and they were incredulous. They said he doesn't want the cash. That doesn't make sense to Morgan Stanley bankers. What Charles Koch realized was that by staying private, he could do two key things. First of all, he would not be beholden to Wall Street investors who might demand control over the firm, but he'd also be beholden to these short-term incentives of quarterly reports. This institution, Koch Industries, thinks on a strategic horizon of years, not quarters. And then secondly, by staying private, they could stay opaque. And this is key to their business strategy. That memo I just mentioned, they say Charles Koch told these bankers that if he went public, outsiders would learn how much money his commodities traders were making. And if they learn how much money the traders were making, they might stop doing business with them. This illuminates why secrecy is such a key part of this business. They don't want outsiders to know what they know, and they don't want outsiders to know what they're about to do.
So we've done several shows about the Koch brothers and Koch Industries, and I guess we haven't really gone too much into detail about where their money actually comes from.
Yeah.
We know that they deal with oil,
mm-hmm.
and what I remember is that they owned, do they still own Dixie Cups?
That's right.
And
yeah.
Lycra?
Yep.
And so all these things that people interact with, and paper towels,
yep.
they interact with these things on a daily basis. But what I found interesting in the book is that they have a global network of trading desks that rival J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. And this was really interesting. So like a lot of other companies, they buy companies and then they, quote, cut costs to boost profits, so they offshore jobs. That a lot of people understand. I think the trading part is really interesting. Like you say, since the 70s, Koch has been one of the largest traders of global energy supplies. It buys crude oil, and then it sells it. So can you talk about how this works and why this is so important?
Yeah, let's back up to the beginning.
Please, yeah.
What is this organization? Charles Koch takes over the company in 1967 when his dad dies. And you're exactly right. At that time, this is an energy firm. It's rooted in the fossil fuels business, buying and selling crude oil and all the rest of it.
And can you explain, how do you buy and sell oil? How does that work?
It's not simple. We're going to talk about trading. And when we talk about it in its most fundamental sense, it is an incredibly complex, volatile, at times profitable, at times simply vicious business. And let's put it in simple terms. You've got two big markets for energy. One is physical oil supplies. And when I say trading, buying oil, trading, buying energy, I mean this company buys oil from the oil well, it ships it through pipelines, it's leasing super tankers full of oil to go from the Gulf of Mexico to the United – I'm sorry, from the Persian Gulf to the United States. It's refining crude oil. It's selling a wide variety, really a rainbow of processed fossil fuels products that come from refining. So this is a profoundly complicated, vitally important business, and it is not easy to succeed in. And so when we look at this company, I have come to the conclusion that in essence, this giant empire whose annual sales are bigger than that of Facebook, Goldman Sachs, and U.S. Steel combined, this massive organization is a trading organization. Whether you're looking at other companies that they buy or whether you're looking at energy supplies they trade, trading is the key. And so when I talk about trading, what I mean is that back in the 70s, they would buy physical quantities of crude oil and sell them. And the price of crude oil could jump or crash depending on all these wild variables. So this is a really hard business in which to make money. And the key to being a successful trader is to know more about the world than anybody else knows in real time. That's why Koch in the very early decades put such an incredible emphasis on data analysis and learning so that they could learn what a barrel of oil was actually worth before anybody else knew what it was. And then when you gain that knowledge, you trade on it. And so they developed an incredible expertise on this because they're one of the biggest traders of energy supplies starting back in the 70s. But they build out and build out and build out on that capacity until you get to the point today where they're not buying and selling crude oil. They're buying and selling whole U.S. corporations like Georgia Pacific, the maker of those paper towels and the Dixie cups you just talked about. Koch put on a massive trade in 2005 worth $21 billion where they bought that corporation as if they were buying a barrel of crude oil. So what they're doing is using superior data analysis and knowledge to execute out in the world in a way that they kind of outpace everybody else.
And to that point, you write that because of the companies that they bought, for example, they bought a trading operating system in Houston, Texas. They bought a natural gas pipeline system in the late 90s. And owning these companies allowed them to tap into Park Service databases to learn things about like snow melt in California, to learn about weather. And then this was also interesting. They hired one of the sharpest meteorologists from the Weather Channel to basically let traders know what the weather was going to be like. So they've got information coming from all aspects of society.
That's right. And this part of the company is the black box inside the black box. It took me years to, first of all, basically understand what they're doing and then to actually be able to report it. And what you're talking about is what was going on in Koch's Houston, Texas trading office, which is one of the biggest nodes of this global trading network. And I love the example you brought up that in the late 1990s, Koch bought a pipeline company called Gateway Pipeline, which included hundreds of miles of natural gas pipeline that was interconnected with our energy system in dozens of different places. They didn't care about the actual pipes or the actual gas. They bought that company for the information it would yield on a daily basis about who was buying natural gas and how much they were paying for it. So then they would take that data, that knowledge, and put it into a central database and then couple it with these other things like their secret internal weather reports that they got by hiring the smart meteorologist who gave them just a fraction of a better forecast of what the temperature was going to be, which helped them determine what energy demand was going to be. They would tap into Park Service databases to figure out snowfall in California, which determines then snow melt, then reservoir levels, and can determine the price of electricity. All this stuff sucked into one database, if you will, in Houston, Texas. And then these traders are spending their days in meetings with each other analyzing it and then making forecasts and making calls and trading off of that knowledge. And if I could, not to go on too long about this, but I want to talk quickly about what these traders are like and the kind of trades they make. Mm-hmm. A Koch Industries trader is not wearing a pinstripe suit and driving a sports car and snorting cocaine and being this wild kind of Wall Street person we think of. This is somebody who probably graduated from Texas A&M. They wear a golf shirt and khakis to work. They're at the desk by 5:30 a.m. and they're spending their entire day in front of spreadsheets. The trades they make are not simple in the sense they're not going to make a big trade that oil prices are simply going to go up or going to go down. That's a sloppy trade with a lot of variables. They're going to make these smaller, very complex trades that, for example, the price of oil in the Gulf of Mexico is going to go up in relation to oil prices in the Northeast. So you're making these smaller trades that are based on very granular, very real-time knowledge about the energy infrastructure system as it exists. And Koch's goal is to win these bets 7 out of 10 times. And that's what they do. And that's how they derive hundreds of millions of profits in trading every year.
They also make massive profits from the oil refineries, which is connected to what we're talking about. You actually compare oil refineries to a broken ATM machine that spits out money all day long.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that works?
I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, okay, Koch is known as a right-wing. Charles Koch, the CEO of this company, has been CEO for 50 years, is extremely libertarian. I'm sure we're going to get into this, but all government intervention is bad. But these politics break down really fast when you get into the real world of how this company makes money and how Charles Koch is one of the richest people on planet Earth right now. The oil refining business, which is a bedrock of Koch's profits, is a fascinating story in America's political economic system today. Here's how I'll put it in real simple terms. First of all, oil is a monopoly. We essentially depend on it to get to work every day, crude oil, and to fly planes. That's changing somewhat with the rise of alternative energies, but it's been the case for decades that we all rely on fossil fuels. And the United States hasn't built a new oil refinery since 1977. Okay, so that's a long time. Over 40 years, we haven't built a new oil refinery. And stunningly enough, the reason for that is the Clean Air Act. You know, Congress passed the Clean Air Act in the 70s to try to clean up air pollution, and they put in this little loophole that said, okay, if you own an oil refinery today, you don't have to obey these brand new rules we passed, but you can't build a new refinery unless it meets our rules. Well, Congress thought that all the oil refineries would eventually break down and kind of wear out, and then we'd have this new generation of cleaner refineries. But big companies with a lot of money can exploit complex regulation. That's one of their specialties. That's one of Koch's core competencies, is mastering complex systems. So what the existing oil refineries essentially violated the laws the United States Department of Justice found in the late 1990s, and they simply expanded their existing refineries under the kind of the old air emissions standards. And so anyone new who tried to come into the business had to operate under the new air emission standards, which made it more expensive. So then over time, the owners of the oil refineries start buying each other out. So ownership is concentrated in fewer and fewer and fewer hands each decade. And what you see is these incumbent economic players who are able to exploit complex law, you know, hire the lobbyists, use the lawyers to do it. They win the game and stifle competition. And the industry's own analysts, I got these reports from, I think, roughly 2017 that show oil refinery profits in the United States are above those around the world by an order of magnitude. I mean, we're talking like $17 a barrel in the United States versus $8 in other places. Those are arbitrary numbers, but they reflect the pattern. So, yes, when you own these assets and you're the major incumbent player the way Koch Industries is, the profits you derive are astounding.
Today, we are speaking with Christopher Leonard, a business reporter and award-winning author. We're talking about his new book, Cokeland, The Secret History of Coke Industries and Corporate Power in America. He worked on this book for almost 7 years and interviewed a number of people who work inside Coke Industries. He talked to whistleblowers. We'll talk about their political influence also in the show. Christopher says that Coke Industries was way ahead of the curve when it comes to grabbing power at the state level. And they have a major, one of the largest lobbying shops in the United States. As you know, Americans for Prosperity, they're able to get people in buses right away to go knock on doors, to go knock on doors in D.C. So they've got major, major influence. As I was reading your book, I was thinking about all the shows we've done in the last couple of weeks about the 4 million people who took to the streets during the climate strike. Just yesterday here in San Francisco, a number of activists shut down downtown San Francisco, and a lot of people got arrested. They stood in front of banks that are funding oil companies. One of the groups, it's an indigenous-led group, Idle No More, they painted these gorgeous murals on two huge blocks of the street, talking about the kind of future that they want to live in. Keep it in the ground, no more oil, renewable energy, a clean future. And I just was reading this book and I thought, what are your thoughts about this? Because there's so much activism. Keep it in the ground is now being talked about by politicians. Mm-hmm. And yet, here you have this powerful corporation like the Coke Industries that's making so much money off of oil. Do you think that, like, what could activists learn about how these companies operate?
So much. And so much. Activists could learn so much about how these companies operate. And I'd like to share what I think is maybe one of the most important observations I had. I thought when I started this book that when I reported on politics, that I knew corporate influence would be a part of it. I thought I'd be writing about campaign donations and super PACs and all the rest of it. I was so wrong. All the political chapters in this book start the day after the election, when everybody's attention goes elsewhere and the nitty-gritty business of governing gets underway. You know, earlier I mentioned these Coke Industries traders. And this is so important because the political strategy is torn straight from the trading playbook. Just as the Coke trader is a button-down, quiet person who's looking at spreadsheets all day, that's exactly what their political operatives are doing. And so Coke's traders know how the energy system works. Well, Coke politically has created a map of political power in America that's just like a pipeline map or a refinery map. They're looking at political powers that actually exist on the level of the state legislatures, the court system, the federal court system, the administrative agencies in Washington, D.C., OSHA, EPA, all the rest of it, the United States Congress, which Coke understands in a very, very detailed way. And so then Coke is looking to go out there and win 7 out of 10 bets, just like they do in trading. So they're going to look to influence the political system at key points where they can, whether it's in the state legislatures, in these boring, long committee meetings that nobody wants to pay attention to. There are going to be 3 Coke lobbyists in the back of that room paying attention, and they're going to be acting on it the next day. The book shows how Coke patiently, and I think quite effectively, derailed the effort to put a price on carbon pollution back in 2010. There was a cap and trade effort, which, you know, was criticized from both left and right. But what it sought to do, in essence, was just make companies pay a price for the pollution they're releasing into the sky. Coke was there during the long marathon of boring, granular policymaking, and it helped absolutely derail that effort. So to me, the biggest lesson is engagement after the elections is the key part. When it gets boring is when you need to start paying attention.
And we're going to take a quick break, but after the break, we'll talk about it got so much media attention when the Koch brothers decided not to support Donald Trump. And the media, I thought the coverage was very strange.
I was laughing at that, as was everybody else in the Koch network.
About the media.
About the media, about the coverage, about this narrative that, like, oh, they're out of politics because they're not supporting Donald Trump. It was laughable.
We'll talk about that after a break. We're speaking today with Christopher Leonard, a business reporter and author of the new book, Cokeland, The Secret History of Coke Industries and Corporate Power in America. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea or feedback, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. You can listen to past shows and also sign up for our podcast there. We just got a phone call, so why don't we do that, and then we'll talk about the Cokes and Trump and politics. Let's go to Pam in San Mateo. Hi, Pam. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning. The author is mentioning how the Coke industries have such a long time horizon for making their decisions. I'm wondering if he knows, do they invest in alternate energy, you know, clean energy like solar, wind? And if not, does he have a sense of why not, since that seems to be a sensible thing to be doing given the way the world is moving?
Thank you.
What a great question. And first of all, let me emphasize your ending point that the world is moving away from fossil fuels. It is a question of how quickly and how dramatically it will. You know, there is a lot of talk in the fossil fuels world right now about this thing called peak demand, meaning that the demand for fossil fuels might actually peak as these other sources of energy rise up. And that is a tremendous threat to fossil fuels companies, the biggest economic threat they face, hands down. And so let's talk about this institution, Koch Industries, that thinks about things on a very long horizon. I have not seen any significant investment in wind, solar, or alternative energies. Why is that? Not only that, but this company has fought, I think, harder than any other company to derail any system that would limit greenhouse gas emissions. Here's the picture I get from having interviewed folks in the corporate and the political infrastructure. Inertia and momentum matters. Coke is deeply, deeply, deeply invested in the fossil fuels business right now. The company has billions of dollars sunk into physical infrastructure, oil refineries, pipelines, just the leases it has on super oil tankers. It has so much money sunk into the fossil fuels industry as it exists today. We're talking billions of dollars. But then think about over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years, the flow of oil that will go through that physical infrastructure. That's Coke's annual revenue, the money it'll make by the crude oil that passes through its refineries and then gets turned into gasoline products it will sell. If we shift to alternative energies, or if we put a price on emitting carbon, it is going to reduce those flows of oil in the future, and it is going to then degrade the value of the physical assets that process it. What I'm saying is that the price tag to a fossil fuel company like Coke is in the trillions when you're looking at a time frame of 30, 40, 50 years, which is an accurate time frame for a big multi-billion dollar investment like an oil refinery, let alone three oil refineries. We're talking a massive price tag that's not easily replaceable by investing in wind farms or solar panels. So this is a huge economic shift, and you can't understate what a big economic shift it'll be. So I think it's, in fact, the long-term thinking that might promote the effort to fight alternative fuel.
So this is going to be a brutal fight going forward, given that just for this one massive company, Coke Industries, you're saying that trillions of dollars are on the line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you measure it over 30, 40, 50 years, trillions of dollars.
Because what's so interesting is, you know, Shell and the Chevrons and BP, they're putting out all these commercials about how they care about the environment and they're going to go green. Coke is not doing that. And so I wonder, given the fact that you've talked to so many people on the inside, how do you see this playing out? Because, like I said, you've got people putting their body. I mean, you think about Standing Rock, mm-hmm. Indigenous people, the water protectors, out there in the freezing cold, putting their bodies on the line to protect their land and to protect their water.
Yeah.
And now you have lots of youth, 10-year-olds,
yeah.
you know, explaining science to their parents and everything in between. So how do you see this fight playing out in the coming years?
First of all, I will talk about Coke, and they are, in terms of fighting, they are more uncompromising than even Exxon or Chevron. But let's not let all the other fossil fuels players off the hook. We're talking about real money on the table. And when there's real money like that, yes, people fight for their interests. I think you might even expect it almost inevitable that the Exxons, the Chevrons, the natural gas, the pipeline companies are going to fight to protect their economic interests, which are threatened by a shift away from fossil fuels. This isn't like controversial or too surprising at all. So when it comes to Coke, the prologue of the book is called The Fighter, and it's kind of this quick, concise little history of Charles Koch. And he's got this very congenial, I think genuinely congenial and humble persona. You know, when I met him to interview him in 2015, it took a long time to get into that room with him in the corporate suites. And I walk into the office and he says, "Oh, Chris, you didn't need to wear a tie to meet with me." You know, that's very Charles Koch. He's a warm, humble guy, but beneath that exterior is a hardcore fighter with a spine of steel. And the prologue walks through how he fought labor unions and broke them, broke their will. There was a really violent, contentious 9-month labor union strike that's in the early part of the book. Charles Koch never wavered, never bent. He fought the federal government when it was investigating the company in the 80s for stealing oil. And he fought the Obama wave. I mean, back in 2010, there was this idea that the Democrats were in a new majority of power. Koch did not back down. They took the fight straight to Obama. They burned the ground, and they won. And on the concerns that were key to them, critically climate change and carbon emissions rules, they won. So what's going to happen going forward? The world is changing. I mean, alternative energy sources are arising in a non-trivial way. And even the internal oil industry analysts recognize we're kind of entering this new phase and there's a huge question mark in the air. But when people are fighting for their economic self-interest, they fight hard. And big companies are very sophisticated about having warm messages that go out to the public and then kind of bare-knuckle tactics that happen in the darker spaces of actual governing and lobbying. And I think I would expect to see people fight to protect their economic interests on this issue and try to forestall and delay any effort to put a price on putting carbon into the sky.
We have another question from Bill in Berkeley who says, given the knowledge acquisition structure the Kochs developed, it seems they should be fully aware of the developing climate crisis and the need to address it. Does their ideology finally trump their knowledge? Now, you got one interview with Charles Koch, and if I remember correctly, one of the conditions you had to agree to was not to ask him about the climate crisis. Is that right?
You know, I need to really think back. I am sorry. I don't think that's exactly right. When I went in to interview him in 2015, he just released a book about his philosophy that he uses to run this company called Market-Based Management, which people at the company have described to me as kind of cult-like. It's this all-in or all-out, all-encompassing philosophy. I wanted to interview him about that. I wanted to meet him, and we kept it constrained to that topic. And I put several requests into the company on a climate change interview. And I listed my questions multiple times. I've been doing this actually for years. I think that's fair to say. I need to go back and look at the paperwork. But I was certainly for years asking for this interview about climate change because I think Bill hit on one of the most pivotal questions. Charles Koch is an engineer with 3 graduate degrees from MIT. This is a person who understands numbers, understands science. The science of global warming's not complicated or controversial. You can get into the weeds about projections and, you know, climate models, how bad's it going to be when, but you can't debate the fact that putting gigatons of greenhouse gases into the skies, making the Earth hotter and disrupting the climate. I don't know what is in Charles Koch's head on this. Does he not believe the science as his lieutenants claim is the case? I mean, even Koch's top corporate lobbyist, Philip Ellender, expressed to me during a 2014 interview that, you know, kind of who knows about climate change? Is it people? Is it not people? Who knows? Climate changes all the time. Or do they really know, and do they think that the market is going to come in and save the day in 10 years with innovative solutions, which I must add is very hard to do if there's no price price is the key mechanism of a market. If there's no price on putting carbon into the sky, the market can never respond to the climate crisis.
Or is it because, and this is my cynical side speaking, are these guys just hardcore capitalists, and for them it's profit at any cost? And if the world burns, so be it. I have more billions in my bank, even though Charles Koch has a son who, I don't know if he has kids, but that's what makes no sense to me. I mean, we just got a report from the IPCC about the oceans. I mean, the changes are happening right before our eyes. It's on the cover of magazines now, yeah. Mainstream magazines. So I don't believe that. These guys have to know what's going on.
So again, I'm at a disadvantage because they wouldn't let me do this interview, and I wish I did. Let me give you two key data points. The first is that I don't know what's in Charles Koch's head, but I have accurately measured the footprint they left behind. They have fought in an uncompromising fashion from the 90s on, not only to derail any effort to put a price on carbon emissions, but to even cast doubt that climate change is a real thing. They've been doing that in a completely uncompromising fashion for decades. They're one of the biggest actors in this fight that has kept us from dealing with this problem. But secondly, in terms of the viewpoint, Charles Koch is an absolute ideologue. In the sense that he truly believes, when I had that interview in 2015 with him, I mean, he believes he's discovered the blueprint for how you should organize human society, and it is as a free market system with virtually zero government intervention, where everybody is engaged in this voluntary exchange, prices dictate everything, there's a price for health care, there's no publicly operated roads or schools or any safety net. Price determines everything. And I think that in his heart, truly, Charles Koch seems to believe this is the best and only way to organize society, and that government intervention only causes more problems than it solves. And so this is a belief that I think is heartfelt and totally uncompromising inside this organization.
What new information did you uncover about how they used extreme climate change denial tactics to influence policies?
Two things. First of all, the way they influence politics is so smart. They've got one of the biggest lobbying operations in the United States. They've got one of the biggest networks of political donors in the United States. They've got an activist group called Americans for Prosperity. But a key thing is they operate this constellation of think tanks that kind of mainstream their ideas without having Koch's brand name on it. One of them is the Cato Institute, which Charles Koch co-founded back in 1977. And there's an agenda from a Cato Institute meeting in 1991 casting doubt on the science of climate change. That was a really key moment. George H.W. Bush, remember, said, we're going to do something about climate change. From that point forward, Koch has been working to push the Republicans off the field. And one of the new things that's revealed in the book, I think, is telling. It's something that's called the echo chamber, that when it looked like Barack Obama and Democrats in Congress were going to put a price on carbon emissions, Koch's political operatives arranged for a third-party think tank called the American Council for Capital Formation to do a report on climate change. Not surprisingly, this Koch-funded report found that if we put a price on carbon, the entire economy was going to collapse, right? And then that report was announced in association with the National Association of Manufacturers, which is a lobbying group, not Koch. Koch's name was never on it. So this report comes out, and then Koch recycles it through these political action groups like the American Energy Alliance, the supposed nonprofit think tank that's headed by a former Koch lobbyist. So then they further amplify this report. Then they create political messages that are broadcast back in Senator Lindsey Graham's home state, because he's vulnerable on this issue, as identified by Koch's well-paid lobbyists. And so then they're pressuring Lindsey Graham off the plate. So that kind of structure and the money trail and the organization that really all traces back to Koch's headquarters in Wichita had never, you know, there's a new thing that we kind of MRI'd.
How do people, I won't even give labels like liberals or the left, how do people who want to completely do a 180 and ensure that we have a clean planet and a healthy planet for future generations compete with all of this? There's nothing like this on the other side. Nothing.
Okay. And what a great question. First of all, I when I was writing the book, I always like to joke, oh, boy, we're in the wrong line of work. We ought to own oil refineries. You know, that's the kind of business you need to be in. That gives a big structural advantage to incumbent players when you own super hyper profitable assets. It gives you a lot of money to use. For example, Coke didn't create the Tea Party. It was a grassroots movement of very frustrated conservative people who felt like the economy had, or the government had gone off the rails. But Coke, because of how much money it had, it could walk in and facilitate the Tea Party. Coke could provide the social networking platform, again, those buses that would take angry voters to D.C. Coke could, out of the box, provide the kind of backroom organization that a real grassroots movement would have to develop over years. And because Coke has so much money, it can, boom, out of the box, do that. So that's one thing. But I guess the point I would make, and the thing that's so instructive about Coke's efforts is the long-term strategy, the fact that they really think about things on a horizon of 5 and 10 years out. And then secondly, the time and attention and patience they have in understanding the real system of political power in America, mm-hmm. and being able to get into the weeds and to be there in the months after the election, to keep following the ball after the election when that ball starts going through the very crazy complex maze of legislation. And so, you know, that seems pretty glib to sit here and say, oh, you know, activists need to hire lobbyists to be there every day to babysit Congress. But you just can't ignore the fact that the real action takes place over a long time period and in these parts of our political system that we've largely started to ignore, the very boring march of policymaking.
And as you point out, they were well ahead of the curve when it comes to state level power. In some states, as you say, you can buy, not in California, but you can buy a state Senate seat for about $50,000 and have a huge influence on policy in that state.
This is what I'm talking about. I wrote a lot about toward the end, the state of Kansas. There's this chapter called The War for America's BTUs. That's a British thermal unit. It's our energy supply. Coke was way ahead of the fracking revolution and exploited it in, frankly, brilliant ways to make a lot of money off of fracking crude oil down in Texas. But then the second part of that chapter shows how they're helping quash and derail competitive forms of energy around the country. You know, Kansas, for example, subsidized wind energy. As I would like to point out, the federal and state governments had also subsidized fracking for decades. Fracking only happened because of state-funded research and tax breaks. But when they started doing it for wind energy, according to the Koch network, it was now crony capitalism. And so, as you say, you know, Charles Koch is very good at identifying undervalued commodities, and state political power is an undervalued political commodity. So they could buy these seats in the state legislature, and this points back to their ability to map things accurately and to understand where real political power lies and to pressure it where they're going to be effective.
I want to spend a couple minutes also talking about how they have affected public health. As we pointed out earlier in the show, they are the 14th worst air polluter in the United States, according to the Political Economy Research Institute. And we just did a show last week about how 9 million people around the world prematurely die from air pollution. A couple other things from PolluterWatch.org. In 2000, Coke was sued by the EPA for being responsible for 300 oil spills that resulted in more than 3 million gallons of crude oil leaking into Palms Lake Stream's coast. So this not only affects the land, the people, but also animals and all other living things that live in those areas. In 2009, Coke settled with the U.S. government for $25 million for illegally removing oil from federal lands and Indian reservations. This was fascinating to learn about. And we don't have that much time, but can you just give us a quick overview of what happened there?
With the oil
theft? With the Indian reservations?
This is a big part of the early part of the book. And all that stuff you just mentioned is definitely documented in depth in the book.
Right.
Coke was the largest gatherer of crude oil in the United States, meaning it was the company that drove out to the oil well, gathered the oil, took it to market. And they systematically put their thumb on the scale. And this is from, you know, I interviewed the people who did it. I've got documentation about it. The government got documentation about it. They'd put their thumb on the scale, and if they took 100 barrels of oil, they'd leave a little ticket behind and say, we only took 98. And so they would gather oil without paying for it to the tune of about $10 million in profits a year. They yielded from gathering oil without paying for it back in the 1980s, and they'd been doing it for years. And it's an instructive episode in the company's history because it shows that when you enter really, really complex arenas where the law is gray, and frankly, the business of gathering oil is gray, it's tough to measure it exactly, you can get away with a lot. And I mean, I have to hasten to point out that Coke had a lot of criminal problems in the 90s and 80s. They did clean up their act in the year 2000. They changed how they did business. There's still problems there today, but they did change things in the year 2000.
You actually got your hands on some documents about how workers are dealing with a lot of health issues. And I mentioned before we started the show in, 2017, the time just goes by, October 2017, we did a show about Company Town, and it's a documentary that follows a group of citizens in Crossett, a small town in Arkansas, and they were fighting for their lives against Georgia Pacific, which is the paper mill and the chemical plant owned by the Kochs. A lot of these people are slowly dying from cancers that a number of scientists linked to the toxins in the paper mill's wastewater and air pollution. And they didn't get help from the EPA, and they didn't get any help from Coke. Mm-hmm. Talk about those documents that you uncovered.
Well, here's what I uncovered, which is kind of a parallel track, if you will. I focused a lot on how Coke operated Georgia Pacific after it bought it, and it used this so-called private equity model that we're seeing across America today, which is, you know, these investors borrow billions of dollars to buy a company. Then they load the debt they just borrowed onto the company itself and then force the company to cut costs and be more productive to pay off that debt. And you can make a lot of money if you do it right, but it puts tremendous strain on communities and workforces. And, yeah, I had somebody inside Georgia Pacific give me 10 years' worth of worker safety data that shows, using Coke's own numbers, that workplace injuries have jumped something like 57% since the year 2010. The workplace at Georgia Pacific is becoming more dangerous every year. Fewer people are doing the same amount of work. The workplace safety rules that were once pushed by labor unions have much less effect now than they used to. You're seeing amputations, burns, all of these very serious injuries rise across the board. And then you've got, you know, who's the outside cop on something like that? You know, I'm thinking of a case of Lydia Faircloth, a woman in Oregon who was killed on the job as she was leaving work. She got run over when she was walking through a pedestrian pathway. And violations were found to have been made on Coke's part, okay? And the fines in these cases, six workers were killed in 2014. The fines were in the range of like $10,000 a person.
Wow.
Okay? For a company like Coke, that's not even, it's not even negligible. And what you see is that when there's not a federal enforcement agency on the job, there's really no incentive to change. All that stuff we talked about in the 90s with Coke, they had record-breaking fines that caught national attention for those pipeline leaks and explosions and things like that. In the case of workers getting killed on the job, there's virtually no media attention, and the fines are, they don't even qualify as paltry. And so what you saw is over the years, the behavior really didn't change, and the workplace continued to get more dangerous at Georgia Pacific.
Wow.
Yeah.
Final thoughts. We talked earlier about how the media coverage was really laughable when the Kochs said they didn't like Trump. When he got to the White House, the Coke network played a vital role on the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. As you say, they transformed the Trump tax cuts into basically a Coke plan.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a lot of disagreements on trade. But they believe that let's dismantle the administrative state, let's put corporate people in power at the EPA and the Department of Interior and on and on and on. What influence are they having today? And what do you think is going to happen in the next couple of years with them? I mean, Charles is what? How old is he now?
He's 83.
83, okay.
Yeah. And still gets to work before the sun comes up.
Wow.
Yeah, as I can personally attest. And so here's why I laughed when I saw these stories that said Coke is pulling out of politics. Okay. giving money to win the White House is like it's like that derivatives bet I talked about earlier, that you're betting the oil prices are going to go up or down. It's a big bet. It's expensive. Lots of variables. It's binary. It's win or lose. That's not Koch's specialty. And I laughed because it's not like Koch doesn't care who's in the White House, but they're flooding their money into that complex infrastructure we talked about earlier of political power so that when Donald Trump wakes up the day after he's president, guess who's there? Koch is there. And, you know, then Trump had to get down to the business of legislating. And when he did that, he realized, boom, there's Koch Industries. And, you know, the relationship between Trump and Koch is highly complex. The Koch network essentially does not like Trump. He's ideologically impure. He'll support, you know, intervention by government tariffs. He's rhetorically, at least, supported, you know, entitlement programs like Medicare, which his voters really care about. So Koch fights him on stuff they disagree with him on, like those things, but they support him in his efforts to dismantle the regulatory state. So it's a complex relationship, and Koch's handling it in a very Koch way with adaptability and patience.
Do you think, we only have 30 seconds left, I hear Bernie talking about the Kochs regularly, but not many other Democrats. Do the Democrats get this? Do they understand what's happening here?
I you know, you look back through history and look back through the book, Koch is very good at using Democrats. It hired a lot of Democratic lobbyists to derail cap and trade, as I show in the book.
And Obama, I mean, he bragged about oil production when he was president, and now the United States is the biggest oil producer in the world.
That's right. Again, hallmarks of the Koch plan are patience and flexibility and obscuring what they do from the outside point of view. So they're very smart about appearing to be bipartisan today.
Christopher Leonard is author of Kochland, The Secret History of Koch Industries and Corporate Power in America. Christopher, thank you for joining us, and thanks for your work.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.